Welcome to the... No, I can't do that. Let's try another one. How about this? No, that won't work either. Let's try this. Yeah, I can get on board with that. Let's roll with it. Welcome to the Begin the Begin podcast. My name is Jeff Hillemeyer, and I'm on a mission to find out what makes people tick. Not just anyone, people who are making a profound impact on the world. I want to dig into their origin story and get to the root of why and how they do what they do. I hope you are as inspired coming out of these conversations as I am. Let's get into it. The Spun Mafia podcast series is a look back at the stories and journey of my first company, Spun Logic. If you enjoy this one, I highly recommend you go back and check out the earlier episodes as well. On this episode of the Spun Mafia podcast, Raghu Kakarala and I chat with Bruce Etroff, Managing Director, Star Mountain Capital. Bruce's firm acquired Spun Logic in March of 2008, and we talk about the process of the acquisition, his view of Engage over the next 5 years, and the ins and outs of private equity, including what you should be considering if you want to sell your business. And hey, while I've got you, definitely consider subscribing on whatever platform you're listening on. I have a lot of great guests lined up that, trust me, you won't want to miss. Okay, let's get into it. Okay, here we are, another Spun Mafia episode. This time, we've got a really special guest, don't we, Raghu?
Oh, yeah. Someone that we got to meet together, learn together, now sitting on the other side of things where we're, it's great to be able to talk to Bruce as a peer.
Yeah, that's right. So Bruce, tell everybody who you are and what you do.
Sure, I'm Bruce Etroff. I am a private equity investor. I had my own firm for over 20 years called Hired Capital, and we actually merged our firm. So I had a little bit of experience last summer into a larger asset manager called Star Mountain Capital. But, you know, we've been investing in growth businesses. That's how we got to meet Jeff and Raghu. And you know, it's a fun job because every day somebody walks into my office or now they walk into a Zoom meeting and you learn, wow, that's a really cool idea. So it's been a joy, but we're always learning. So we're going to learn something today as we talk about.
That's right. Well, and Raghu, you're a new person since the last time we did a Spun Mafia. So tell everybody what you're up to real quick.
Yeah, you might have seen me last on the day that I sold talking to Jeff. Actually, sneak peek, we actually recorded it a week before it closed. And luckily, it didn't jinx it. And then Jeff until close. So I co-founded 44 with a couple of partners on January 1st. 2015, 1 year and 1 day after the non-compete ended, Bruce.
Absolutely. It tends to be an important date for entrepreneurs.
Met a great set of folks over the summer as we were looking to see how to grow, and met someone that I met because of Bruce in Colton King, who was at KRG Capital at the time and now has his own private equity fund with Mountain Gate Capital. We immediately recognized each other and he wished that he had been successful in acquiring us, initially at Ansira and then Olson, and said maybe the third time is the right time, and it was for us. And we ended up closing on December 4th. And since then it's been a whirlwind, but it's been a great several weeks meeting a bunch of new folks at Bounteous. It's been going really well and look forward to a great year together.
Awesome. Well, let's get into how we know Bruce. So for those who don't know, if you haven't been keeping up with the podcast, Bruce and his firm, Halyard, acquired Spun Logic in March of 2008. And so
it's good timing for you.
That's right.
Bruce, April 2008 was our best month ever as Spun Logic.
Fair. I love it. So Raghu and I we've talked about this, but Raghu and I were really leading the charge on the acquisition process so that Danny and Raj could keep running the shop. And when we first met Bruce, it was an epic meeting in our minds. And so, Raghu, I'm going to let you set that up. I'm curious from Bruce's perspective.
I don't even remember it, so don't worry.
All right, Raghu, set the stage.
So we met in Chicago, and there was actually a direct marketing association.
Oh, DMA,
Yeah, that brought a lot of people up there. Stan,
Stan was probably there, yeah.
Yeah, and I believe you had a suite at the Drake Hotel or a meeting room.
Meeting room, yeah, maybe.
But it was set up with like...
Well, I guess we had already bought, 10 United and during Pack, right? So yeah, so it was probably an engaged suite.
So it wasn't around like a conference table. It was casual furniture, and we sit down, and there was a tiny amount of pleasantries. And then Bruce started rattling off like a machine gun, a series of questions around, balance sheet, growth, margins, why you do certain things, why you're not in certain things. And we had prepped quite a bit, right? We were going to know about ourselves as well as we could. That was our job, right? So after a while, Jeff started looking at me because there was a whole series of financial related questions and Jeff was deferring. And as I would start answering the question, as soon as Bruce realized that I was going to answer the question correctly, he cut me off and asked the next question.
I've hopefully matured in my approach, but and that's part of it, right? Is that you hopefully get to a point where, because look, I always tell people when we're looking at buying businesses, we have to assume that we're getting the gold laden story, and that our job is to focus on 90% of the time is to focus on what could go wrong, right? Because when things are going well in business, everyone's happy, right? Lots of nice dinners and celebratory, but and that's part of it. But yes, that you definitely caught me on a day where I can have that approach, where I can be pretty direct.
Well, the great part about it is I had read a book a long time back, and I had read it again maybe a couple months before our meeting. So Liar's Poker, there was this section in there about a guy with the nickname the Human Piranha.
And most people think, it's funny because my brother's in the broader Wall Street business, and he always used to say, I'm the nicer brother, but I guess, that day,
Well, you didn't say a single curse word at all. So it was kind of unlike the book in that way. I mean, but just sort of that nice aggressiveness and go, I'm like, wow.
And had you guys met Stan yet? Or was that the first meeting already? Because I think Stan was usually doing reconnaissance, right? So he softened you up, gave you the soft shoe, and sold the vision. And it had the numbers guy with the eye shade come in. And
but it was a great entree into that. Honestly, I mean, worst case, we didn't know the answers. I mean,
right. Yeah, no, for sure. Well, you guys were very sharp, and so obviously, the net of it is, right, we obviously, made an offer to buy the business. So, and that's one of the things I've learned over time is it's hard to read these meetings, right? Sometimes some of your worst meetings, even in the client side, right? Sometimes you think, okay, sometimes you have a good chemistry and you know it's good and it's going well. Other times you walk out, you think you lost and you end up being the winner. So it until you get to know people a little bit better and know their style, that's obviously the benefit of us all working together, then we get to know each other's style a little bit better.
Yeah. And I should point out too, these things don't always end up well in terms of relationships. And we've always thought very highly of you, Bruce and John. And,
likewise. And one of the things that I'm most proud of at Engage, and is that the number of children it spawned and you guys are just two of many. I mean, it's probably of all of our portfolio companies ever, this one has spawned the most entrepreneurs. Like if you think about it, if you look at actually the number of people that touched Engage, who ended up being in their own business on some share of shorts, so about a dozen.
Yeah.
Which is actually pretty impressive.
So anyways, we're friends and we can speak honestly. Meeting, we didn't dislike you in that meeting. We were just like, we came out of there and we're like, what just happened? I think it was the only meeting we had where we were like, did we do great or did we do terrible? We had no idea. And Raghu, you did all the heavy lifting. So that was, I'm curious, Bruce, we've never talked about this from your side, as you guys were looking at Spun Logic and presumably other shops,
right.
Were there points where you're like, I don't think it's these guys, were some of the partners, like how did that go from your side?
Yeah, I mean, it's, well, as you may recall, we were very focused on a digital component to the solution, right? 10 United was our broad agency, Direct Impact was our CRM, data-driven, and then we really felt like digital was such a key component. And so, you know, we were just, what I always like to do is try to understand how well people know their business. Ultimately, especially for a platform build, we actually rely on the management team to make sure. And we'll talk about that, you know, subsequent questions, you know, and it's the hardest thing for us to assess because everyone has to kind of work well together. And an M&A platform strategy is way harder to pull off than just an organic growth strategy, because as you guys lived through multiple times, you've got to put, you know, different companies, cities, cultures together. But we like that you were, you know, young, driven, had just a good energy, had landed some big clients in Atlanta, you know, the Home Depot at the time, which is, you know, a good hallmark for a small company. As you know, they're not easy, you know, clients to reel in. And that's kind of, you know, one of the things we try to kind of separate, really kind of companies that aren't ready, you know, have they kind of at least done, you know, gone to war with procurement and some of the other kind of structural issues you have when you're dealing with big businesses.
Yep. Got it. Okay, good. Well, there's one other story that we, as Raghu and I were thinking about chatting with you. I think, Raghu, you guys went to Bruce's favorite restaurant. Is that right?
Which one did we go to, Raghu?
Roy's Hawaiian.
Oh, Roy's Hawaiian. Yeah. Where was that?
I think we've gone twice, once in Atlanta, but this particular
in Atlanta.
Was on the water in San Diego.
In San Diego, sure. That was probably another DMA.
Yeah, it was another DMA. It was yourself and I and Dave Grislak, if you remember him.
Sure, Grislak, sure, yeah.
Yeah, and Michael McCaffin, who, our client from Chick-fil-A, we were all eating together. And as we were talking, I forget how many years into the acquisition we were, probably a couple years in, pretty well integrated and everything. And then one of the questions came up about the cruise. And all along, at one point, I forget, somebody's answer early on was, yeah, maybe that's something we'll think about, you know, bringing back, not you know.
But we should pause and say that up until the sale, we had done, I think, 7 or 8 straight annual company trips.
Absolutely.
Just every year. And then we sold. Okay.
Yeah. So the problem would always be in January or February. So the fact that we sold in March, we had just had one.
Right.
So it wasn't even a point of discussion around the company until about like 8, 9, 10 months later. They're like, hey, what about this year? You know, and we're like, you know, financial crisis, you know, reset some things. But
right, right. The first year, exactly. Because that was the teeth of the Lehman debacle, right? So
yeah. Until another year passes, and I think we were at Roy's enjoying that. And I brought that up, and you're like, yeah, really, it doesn't have anything to do with the cost or anything. It's like, you know, I've got investors, and if I'm telling them I'm going to put all my human assets onto a bus filled of alcohol, drive it down to Florida, put on a cruise with more alcohol, and then have them come back, I'd be a complete idiot. So yeah, we're not going to be doing that anymore.
Well, and not only that, so we actually did. So we had another company, another marketing company. You may remember we had a higher education marketing company in Hoboken, and we actually did a cruise around New York. And in the middle of our cruise, we had, you know, everybody in the company, and then the tech people had come and they had brought their laptops. Actually, our main site crashed. And so the Circle Line driver's like, we're not going back. And the guys are like trying to scramble. Yeah, we had about 18 minutes of downtime because of that cruise. So, you know, so maybe.
Raghu, we forgot
to ask. We'll divide and conquer next time, Raghu. You'll do it in like segments. So
now we know, Raghu, you got to always ask the buyer, what's your feeling on annual company trips?
Yeah.
That might have been a deal breaker.
Yeah, you know, there's always the people, it's like, you know, the right kind of buyer overpays because they think they're too confident about the future. And then you have the people that understand risk like Bruce, who pay the right amount.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And then look, look, we're in a crazy world today, right? You guys are dealing with it. You know, it's funny because we obviously all lived through 08 together, and that seemed to be more in concert, right? The economy was going through a tough time, the world was going through a tough time, and you know, everybody's business suffered. It wasn't surprising that we had a tougher year, you know, as we worked our way out of it. And you know, the thesis, right? Today, we've got this kind of crazy backdrop of the pandemic. You know, we've had this obviously unstable situation in DC that hopefully will work itself out. And then the markets are on fire. And it's not just, you know, the private markets that we deal with. Public markets, you probably, you know, I don't know if you guys follow what's going on, what's called SPACs. Yeah. They're these kind of public vehicles. It is a little bit crazy. We all know that it's got to end somehow and it's not going to be pretty. So, I mean, I think, Raghu, you were smart to, you know, find a good partner. It's always a hard call as to when to sell or when to kind of bring in capital, because you don't, no one's ever a fortune teller, you know, never know exactly, but you know, you do it when it feels right to yourself and when, you know, you're ready to make that kind of personal decision.
So Bruce, honestly, part of the thesis, when I look at the macro picture for what happened at Engage, we'll dive into some other details that we did a lot of details during the Fund Mafia things earlier in the year.
But, yeah, I learned a lot. I didn't even know about that Joe Kaufman situation. We'll talk about that another day, but I learned a ton.
but we look about it and we're like, hey, we had these clients in Atlanta as fund up through, you know, 08. Fast forward to 2013, Jeff and I were talking to Cisco in India. We had a China office.
I remember had that Engage China adventure. The thesis I think was spot on, right? I mean, yeah. I think even today still you have the big agency holding companies with these kind of multiple verticals, and they're doing a little bit better job if you followed them, where they've tried to break down the walls. They'll have one healthcare agency. And we happen to have a pharma marketing business today. So we kind of live in that world. So they're doing a little bit better, but yeah, you know, Raghu, the thesis was right, I think. And I think obviously it was getting a lot of energy. The craziest thing about that deal, you guys talked about it on another episode, is how quickly Publicis blew that thing up. I mean, yeah. I've actually never seen a buyer so quickly, you know, do the kind of damage they did. And that, talk about a disjointed process where the people who ultimately ran it had nothing to do with buying it. I mean, it was really kind of, that's a lesson in dysfunction for anybody.
You wouldn't think though that the person who didn't pay enough attention would also be the high bidder.
Well, no, I think it was really the business development. They have kind of corporate arms that have a mandate to kind of grow, and then, you know, they brought the Atlanta team in very, very late in the process. Mm-hmm. And you guys obviously were much more involved. I had a view of much further, but obviously, you know, losing Nationwide and those sorts of things. But yeah, that's. And strategics will do that. They it's one of the reasons why if you can get them to buy, they do things that are irrational, sometimes motivated. Whereas it motivated by not the most purest economic issues, they've got some target to hit. They also have obviously tons of liquidity today. So if you can wrangle a strategic, it's very hard in the marketing agency world. It's only gotten harder. That's the one thing, you know, we think a lot about. We obviously still own a bunch of marketing businesses, but we haven't gotten back into the pure agency business yet because the agency holding companies are buying very few. You'd be better off in some specialty areas like you guys are. Like, I know you're in e-commerce. You know, some healthcare has been better because obviously pharma has been, you know, much more dynamic. So it's just something to think through. And the other thing is that people businesses overall across all industries are always harder to sell because the assets walk out every day. So. Mm-hmm. You know, if I buy a piece of software, you know, and I have the tech team, right? No one really cares what my CEO looks like when they, you know, where he or she, you know, does, as long as the software performs. You know, there's no creative element to it. You buy, you know, your Microsoft products because they function, right? Not because, you know, whoever, you know, the current CEO. So it's just a very different dynamic. And so there's always been a bias towards those type of, you know, recurring revenue businesses. You know, now people pay a ton of money for them, but we've always felt good about people business because someone has to get the work done. You just have to really, you know, make sure you have the alignment, and that's tricky. It's tricky. So,
well, Bruce, if you had told us in that first meeting that if things go according to plan 5 years later, Jeff and I would be selling into Nike, have a China office that got voted social media agency of the year in China. I mean, you know, the socialists really knew social media. Who knew? and if you had said that, we'd be international, we'd be right. Like a bunch of the top Fortune 50 brands. We said, wow, if we do that, that would be the best possible outcome. And that was the outcome in the middle,
right?
Because of the downturn and all this stuff, and you know, a bit of recap, recapitalization and some other things, did the final financial outcome match the level of success we actually had as a agency?
For us, it was a fine deal. Like, you know, we always say, like, you know, we're more proud of the ones that we kind of hang in there and kind of persevere through. Obviously it's always great to celebrate the big victories, but no, I think it was a good outcome. It was a particularly good outcome. There's a reason why people rate most funds by vintage, because if you were like, if you invested quite a bit in the first 18 months of 07, 08, like we did, and that our fund is still actually going to generate a significant gain of that vintage, that's pretty impressive. So that means we hung in there. You know, we took a few hits like everybody, and then we kind of came back and made some good investments. What happened in 08 had nothing to do with people on this podcast, right? We didn't contribute to it. We couldn't solve it. So you just, you know, and I think a little bit of the pandemic's that way, right? If you were in the restaurant business, you couldn't do anything really, unfortunately. You could pivot, you could be nimble, you could try to get your takeout business, you could build an outside hut, but people that were in digital businesses just persevered better over the last year. We were fortunate because we didn't have a lot of consumer exposure, but we weren't smart about it. We don't really know those industries. So it wasn't by design as much as it was an area that we're just not that knowledgeable about. So.
Yeah. You know, when you think about, you listen to lots of stories on the Spun Mafia podcast, and I know that one of the things I always appreciated about Halyard was you were there when we needed you, and you were there when you needed to push us, but you really sort of let us run the business. And so probably there were things you heard that you maybe hadn't heard before. I'm sure there's lots of other stories. I'm just curious if there's things you remember or things you heard on that brought back a memory of those.
Obviously the one that I do remember, because you're right, we try to let the groups kind of come together naturally, right? We never went to like integration meetings because that would be unnatural. That would be like your father making sure the children all play well together, right? That's never really a good success. But I do remember, when Jeff reached out to us, and you do recall it on one of the sessions, where things were not going well and Jeff was going to fly the coop, and we're like, no, that we can't have that happen. So, and we had to intervene, in an unnatural fashion, but just sometimes we do, right? And we have to step in to maybe make some tougher decisions or fill the gap or make some people choices. And we always like to say, we don't like to get our information just from one source because it could be very jaded. So we always tell all of our companies, look, we're going to deal with the CEO, CFO, but don't be surprised that one day we pick up the head of sales and we just want to get a market read because I just think that allows us to make better decisions. We always say the worst thing for any kind of private investor is not to get the good information, because you're basically like, it's like driving without the odometer and the speedometer, all the things you need, the feedback you need to make the right decisions. And we were being managed a little bit there, as you know. So, and we weren't getting, the right inputs. Ultimately, what we peeled back out, as you guys know, was much more successful. It was, and the nucleus, the components were there, and there's always some egos and personalities involved in these sorts of things. You have to try to, peel that back, but that's one thing we learned. And that had been the first agency we had owned. We had owned other marketing companies. So we're also just much, I like to tell people, we try just not to we make plenty of mistakes. We try not to repeat the same ones over and over again. And so I think I would have a slight bias in the agency business of more of a buying a core business with kind of much smaller tuck-ins, which are, where people clearly didn't have standalone businesses, but they had capabilities or they had skill sets or they had maybe one client that no one, because I just think, in pure integration, is hard in these in the kind of businesses you run, particularly geographically, distant. So I'd be curious your guys' thoughts if you guys feel similarly about the challenge. And Raghu's about to go through it again, so maybe the third time he'll nail it, right?
One thing we learned from that is the A part is easy. It's just money. The M part of M&A is where, you know, it really comes in, especially now in fairly easy money economy like this. The acquisitions come really easy, but the mergers aren't any easier than they ever are.
Right.
Regardless.
And you're right, though. The A part is easy. I tell people all the time, I don't like to be congratulated on buying something. It means I just paid the most. I like to be congratulated when I sell something for more than I bought. And that means that it was a successful outcome. So.
Right.
Yeah, no, totally. And, you know, and you go through it and like, hey, I'm really conscious of like, you know, what the M part looks like. And
right.
You learn, and look, part of it is we learned some lessons in 08 and 09 that were never going to be learned unless you experienced them right then.
Absolutely.
You know.
Absolutely. I always tell people, like, you know, people ask me how long I'm going to do this for. I'm like, we're very much in a pattern recognition business. And so, you know, we kind of faked our way in the early days. And, you know, we made some good decisions. We made some bad decisions. But, you know, and the more things I see, the better, you know, partner, board member, value-added advisor I can be to companies. I mean, we made a new investment in, you know, in a related area. I actually introduced Jeff to the CEO, a really interesting kind of YouTube brand safety and suitability business. And, you know, we've got 10 things we can help them with immediately because, you know, it is kind of cumulative. And I'm sure you feel the same way. You're now on, you know, versions 3.0 of your own business plans. And, you know, there are some things that you'll get to easily. You'll find different challenges and different issues. Each business has its own, but, you know, you'll hopefully get some more of the basic stuff down, right? And that's the whole beauty of it.
Well, per your point about, you know, a larger core and then tuck-ins, I think that was one of the takeaways from that. And that was probably the big learning from the Publicis debacle, because we were, if I remember right, about 42 million top line. I think Moxie, who Publicis combined it with, was about 60 million top line. So there was clearly a bigger and a smaller agency, but not by a wide right. margin. In reality, when you factored in growth rates, we would have been the same within 18 months, right? They were saying relatively the same, shrinking a little bit, and we were picking up in growth.
Right.
So when you combine, what do you do with the two teams? Well, if it's a tuck-in acquisition, yeah, there's one or two, you know, important folks that you look and you kind of level them up at the same level as it top folks over here, and then make some other smart decisions and keep your best talent, but you know, you move forward. When you're talking 60-40, if you just moved everybody down and over because you couldn't deal with the complexity of the M, because the M was too much for you and you didn't want to put too much effort in it, you just lost them.
Well, yeah. I remember, so I was the only person that didn't go forward, right, into Moxie. I remember it was probably 6 weeks after I was talking to someone at the old Engage office, which, you know, the whole, I don't know, 140, 150 people were still at in Atlanta. And the CEO of Moxie still hadn't come to meet them.
Yeah.
I mean, this was a month and a half. And I was like, okay, she wasn't in, she probably wasn't even consulted on this. Like she clearly was not, because that's insane. It's a 5-minute drive from
there. Yeah, no, I hear you.
So, and I don't blame her. I mean, I think she probably was forced on her and she had a lot of stuff going on. So that truly, but I think going back to your point, Bruce, I do think there ought to be a clear lead dog and finding shops that I think trying to make three the way we did that, probably, even though there was the Columbus office was really where we were quote unquote headquartered and where the CEO was. I think it was made it tougher because people didn't really know their lane.
Well, Atlanta was really the growth engine. I mean, it was easier. Austin obviously was a much smaller piece of the business and ended up being smaller. So that was less of it. But no, you're right. And each one is a little bit of a different formula. And sometimes it depends. We're involved in a totally different sector today, some physician practice transactions. And, you know, there, the integration is all in the back office, right? You know, if you're a orthopedist or you're a dermatologist, you're seeing your own patients. You're just hoping that the platform can make the paperwork, the bill collection, the insurance reimbursement, which is kind of the nightmare of that business. So it's just a very different solution set, even though it's a people business, right? You know, and you know, if you get some critical mass, you can do some regional marketing, which most of those you know, kind of practice. Every business has a slightly different dynamic. The one thing also that's really misunderstood, I mean, the problem is I think the broader consumer still kind of associates private equity with like Mitt Romney and, you know, sort of being dragged through the mud. I mean, at the end of the day, we're a liquidity solution for our private businesses that really 25 years ago had no liquidity solution. So if you were in the marketing business, you know, a generation ago, the best you probably could do is you would probably sell it to one of your partners who was younger than you. You know, you'd get maybe some note and pay it back. So that's kind of lost often on people that, you know, there's liquidity for, you know, entrepreneurs like you both that just didn't exist, you know, before the private equity industry. And I think, you know, it's a role that we think, you know, fills an important gap. And particularly in the physician market, which we had no liquidity options historically. Same thing, kind of junior partner model.
So I want to pivot a bit into talking a little bit more about the industry, but I do have an idea for you.
Sure. Always in the idea business.
I just can't help but think. So you take Engage, and what you had was four of us that were entrepreneurs that had started something from scratch, right? So you've got entrepreneurs that have been successful. If you had said, hey guys, stay with it for a year, and then I'm going to back you starting a new one, maybe in a slightly, you know, maybe focused on healthcare or focused on, but, and get equity in the next things the four of us did, but you kept us having some equity in the first thing. And over that year, we helped transition and stuff. I think you'd have made out really well.
Yeah, for sure. And that's kind of some of the structural issues in the private capital markets, which is our mandate is not to invest in like startups or earlier stage companies, right? So, but I would have been happy to back you folks. I could have done it a little bit personally, but not enough to kind of make it work worth your while. But that is kind of some of the challenges, and we're always happy to work with our entrepreneurs again. And many times, what happens is as they grow, like you probably actually don't want them. You want to take it further along because that's where you actually create the most value. Mm-hmm. So if you can get it far enough along with your money, less outside money, and then, you know, wait to critical mass before you bring an outside partner, it's a better.
If you had done that when we first sold, we were 30. I was 31, 32.
Yeah, for sure.
I would have said, absolutely. You mean, Bruce, you're going to buy this, and then in a year I start a new thing and you're going to fund it? I'd have been in.
No, I hear you. That's what the venture growth market does. So, and we actually did some early venture investing. It's just a very different discipline. You've actually got to make like 20 investments. You actually have no idea what your grand slam is going to be. And the model is one investment is going to return the fund. And out of 20, like five are going to return some money, 10 are going to lose money, and 10 are going to be bankrupt. You're not even going to get to that point. So it's, you know, you have to have actually a much different discipline approach where we tell people, look, we're in the business of singles and doubles. And if something really works, then we'll hit a home run. We can make 4, 5, 6 times our money, which is great, obviously. But we also are just happy to make some singles and doubles because that's, you know, we're stewards of capital, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we're some you know, version of what Fidelity does. If our returns aren't good, our investors are not going to give us more money. So far, so good. Right. But, you know,
so that's a perfect segue. So talk a little bit about private equity firms, what typical returns you are looking for, how long you typically look to hold businesses, you know, what you're looking from a risk portfolio.
No, absolutely. And honestly, the market has really matured so that it's very stratified today. So there was a time period where if a private equity firm owned a business, you know, you could assume 3, 4, 5 years down the road, it was going to be sold. And that's probably the typical time frame. In a hot market like we are today, average holds are down. People are in something, they've made money in 2 or 3 years. They're like, okay, you know, trees don't grow to the sky. We might want to sell this. So we're on the shorter end. We've owned a business for, I think 9 years. And there are some funds set up with perpetual capital that they like to own businesses where they would like to make an investment and think it's a great long-term trend to own it for 20 years. But I'd say the average is 3, 4, 5. And, you know, our returns are, our expectations are lofty. We're trying to make, you know, a 20% return, and we're trying to make probably 2 to 3 times every dollar invested back. I'd say return expectations, they won't talk about it publicly. Most of the big firms, they've come down. I mean, rates are down. So most of the big firms, if they make 12 or 14%, they're totally happy. And we all know in our own portfolios, if we make 10%, we're ecstatic. I think everyone's looking at their year-end statement and they were thinking, wow, the markets really are crazy. We made money last year in a pretty significant way by doing nothing, by just buying the S&P 500. So it's in that order of magnitude. There's so many different styles though. You've got everything, I think of it as a continuum, everything from like seed, you know, which is like an idea on a napkin, to really mature cash flowing buyouts. And there's probably 20 years ago, there was 10 flavors, you know, 10 years ago, there was 10 more, and now there's probably 50. And people are deep specialists. And so in our world, you know, we stick to three or four sub-industries, right? We stick to marketing, we stick to IT, things that we really know about. Because at the end of the day, we have a better probability of being successful if we've got a little bit of, you know, perspective on the industry, and it's hard. So, but, you know, and KRG as an example, obviously Mountain Gate now, you know, they've got investment, you know, history as well. And so they've, you know, that's part of the premise, and you got to pivot. That's the other thing. I'm sure you feel the same thing about your business. We used to own radio stations and TV stations. If we stayed in that marketplace, we would be long out of business. So that hasn't made sense for a good, you know, 18 years, but we used to own them and we actually made good money on them. So, you know, part of our exercise is like, what's next, right? And even in the agency world, the agencies really have a very different flavor to them. There are very few kind of basic creative and, you know, kind of production type agencies that you would have maybe seen before. They're all skinned differently. They're e-commerce, or they're around an ecosystem like, you know, Salesforce, or, you know, where there's a particular, you know, dynamic there. But it's, you know, it's a broad industry, and I'd say the good news for entrepreneurs is there's pretty much a home for almost everybody if they have size. I would say minimum size. You know, you have to have a business that's worth, I'd say, at least $20 million ish. You know, if you're going to be the platform, maybe, yeah, that would be the super small size. You know, and look, if you're a SaaS business, that could be, you know, $5 million of ARR. So, you know, it just depends on what business model you have, but there's a lot of capital out there. So it's a good time to be an entrepreneur for sure.
Raghu, when you just went through the process, I know what I just would want to share how valuations work in our industry and what multiples you think are out there, and see if Bruce agrees.
Jeff asked a question that I really shouldn't be talking about on the call right after.
You can talk about ranges.
You can,
right?
You can talk it in generality, and I can be specific, Raghu, because I've been outbid on five things in the last 3 months. So
perfect.
Yeah. You know, I mean, there's ultimately for a digital agency, there's kind of two guide rails that you stay in between in the valuation, taking a look at multiple of EBITDA, and then also you have to make sense on a multiple of revenue basis, because one can get whacked. You know, if you've got some anomaly in your figure and you're a good agency, you haven't generated a lot of revenue yet, but I mean, a lot of profit yet, but you have good revenue, there's still value there, because, you know, you can take a look at it. Or you're a highly tuned agency on EBITDA. And I think 44, definitely, we were very mature on operations. We had like a great team on understanding how to optimize and make the best of what we had. Then you could say, hey, if you look at purely at EBITDA, you're like, whoa, you know, that's great. But, you know, you do need to have a foot in the ground of saying, hey, you're not paying, you know, 3+x on revenue on a services business. So I think, you know, taking a look at multiple of revenue of and multiple of EBITDA, and then that triangulates to what Bruce is going to talk about, because I'm not going to say any specific things.
No, I think, and I would just add, what there's two other elements that I think have become increasingly important. One is revenue growth, and particularly gross margin growth, because people are paying for growth today.
Yeah.
And so they'll be happy if you were growing gross margin dollars at 20% and EBITDA less because you were investing in sales. You'd get credit for that today. And we have a cyber business, and yeah, that business has been really, that's the primary metric. The other thing is gross margin percentage is becoming hugely important, because it actually says a lot about the operating leverage in the business. We really like these businesses with high gross margins. Our pharma marketing company has gross margins like in the mid 70s, and which means that they're not leveraging people necessarily to do. They do some data and targeting. They have a kind of proprietary stack, Which means also I can invest a ton in marketing and salespeople because I can pay them a bunch because the incremental client is worth, you know, 75 cents for every dollar of revenue I generate. But yeah, the multiples are, you know, I'd say on the EBITDA side, you know, they're dipping into the double digits. I mean, for the bigger businesses, there was a trade just a couple weeks ago, a big healthcare agency called Fingerpaint. You know, we bid for in the first round like 13 times and didn't get a meeting. So we're assuming it went north of that. You know, when you get to be sub 5 million of EBITDA, that's part of the premise, by the way, is why you do these aggregation plays. Sub 5 million of EBITDA, I think you're still in the kind of 6, 7, 8 times EBITDA range with like Regu says, kind of a check on revenue. But the, you know, but then you have companies like Moat, which is, you know, kind of a, you know, a safety validation fraud detection software business. Oracle paid like $800 million for and didn't have any EBITDA. So it depending on where you sit in that world. But I'd say in the agency world, yeah, you're still generally EBITDA driven. The big thing in the agency world on deal structures is that if you sell to the holding companies and you're an entrepreneur, you get these kind of massive long-term earnouts, as you know. And they're very hard to manage. So they'll go 5, 6, 7 years sometimes. Which is not that attractive to some people, where at least, you know, when you're partnering with a private equity firm, the buyers know that that's not something that's viable. So you kind of get away from that structure. But that operating leverage is key. It's even key, I think, as people think about how the agency business is going to evolve. Anywhere you can get some technology, software, tools that will allow you to, instead of having to do what we used to have to do, like every time we want a new piece of business, find 5 more people to execute it. If you can use, you know, software, and obviously e-commerce is great for that, because whether the people are, you're getting a percentage of gross spend, right? CPV, you know, you're gonna, you know, if you can drive those average transaction prices for your clients, you know, you can drive more value. We've been a big believer in performance advertising forever, and because I think you kind of put your money where your mouth is. You know, our very first business we invested in the space, so I sold 4 times and finally got sold to a big strategic. You know, it's a great story. We bought it out of bankruptcy in 2003 for $10 million. We sold it 4.5 years later for 185. So we thought we were like geniuses. We were happy. We made 12 times our money. It's our all-time record on. It got sold 4 subsequent times, and Willis, the big insurance company, bought it last year for $1.4 billion. So, you know, I'm not unhappy. You know, but you know, it just shows that when you're in the right part of the market, and yeah, I don't know if you followed what's happening in kind of consumer insurance, but it's become a, you know, a marketing business where historically it was all through agents. So they've really disrupted, you know, and obviously collectively, I know you used to, you know, we used to do a lot of work for Nationwide, but that's the perfect example where it's all gone direct to consumer with much more sophisticated tactics.
And I think ultimately, at least on the, you know, when you're talking about these kind of firms, being a generalist agency is going to be the bulk you would need to be considered something that to be acquired is.
Right.
Quite large. Really what they're buying is size at that point, market share or size. Whereas when you actually have a specialty and you pick the right kind of specialty, kind of, you get a lot of high leverage because you then could get tucked into a company that could then bring that service to a much broader set of customers, right? Yep. So what they're willing to pay for you versus what they can get out of you as a really good delta. Because they can take your skill sets, take your reach, and bring it to a pretty wide audience.
Yep.
That said, when this call ends, we can talk more, Bruce.
Well, we are
good job negotiating. So I'm sure you got a good deal.
We are getting toward the end. I don't want to end without giving some advice to our entrepreneur friends that listen to this, that have dreams of selling one day. And most of them are going to be in the space that we've been talking about. So I'll take advice starting with Bruce, but from either of you on like, what would you recommend to entrepreneurs to make themselves an attractive business for private equity?
Yeah. I mean, I think, look, first of it is just be prepared, right? I think the hardest thing for the first time people kind of approach the institutional market is, you know, really kind of do your homework and get your information, because, you know, we're information and data driven. We want to see, you know, revenue by month by client, because we, you know, we like to hear the strategy and the talk over, but if the numbers match the, you know, the dialogue, then it's even more compelling. So I say that's the biggest thing out of the gate is take a little bit extra time. You know, look, you're good. I would recommend, as much as, you know, against my interest, you know, hire a good investment bank. I know you've both talked about that historically. I don't know, Rick, who you used this time, but I don't know if you used that media again. But yeah, there's, you know, I think they just how they've seen the movie enough times to get you prepared, and then really try to figure out, put yourself in the shoes of the investor, because I think, you know, the best deals I always feel like are win-win. You know, you want your investor to make money. We want the entrepreneur to make more money, and you know, try to understand, you know, where you want to take the business, because I think so many people kind of come in and say, yeah, we want to sell. You want to stay? No, we don't want to stay. We'd actually like to check out SK. Well, what are we left with? You know, and that's a big issue. Like, you know, and a perfect example, when Jeff told us he wasn't going to continue with Engage, we at least planned around it. I mean, you talked about it on one of the podcasts. So it's way harder to sell a business with key people leaving. So if that's part of your plan, and, you know, maybe you're at that age in life where you want that to happen, you should put that plan into motion years ahead of time. Mm-hmm. Some yep. sort of, you know, kind of, you know, continuity, legacy, succession, you know, it's really an important component. But, you know, that's the big thing. And be realistic. I mean, I think, you know, you just have to approach the market. You know, it's okay if you don't get something done or you don't get to the number you're happy with. That's fine. But, you know, it's as you both know, it's time consumptive, right? It's an exhaustive all-in process. And, you know, you're trying to find shelf space against 10,000 other businesses that are also trying to raise capital. So, you know, trying to find your piece of the world that'll connect with you is going to take some effort. So that's just a few thoughts.
Raghu, what do you think? You've done it a few times.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, if you're not attractive to your clients, you're not going to be attractive to a buyer of the company as a whole. So, you know, you can kind of line up the right metrics of running your firm as part of attracting new clients. And, you know, if you're in demand from clients, you'll be in demand in the macro sense from investors. That's it. I think there's two pieces. They say not to do market timing for individual stocks, and, you know, that's really hard. When was the right time to sell Tesla? You know, you should have sold it any time over the last several years.
Exactly. You would have been fine. Exactly.
So market timing for stocks and stuff is extremely hard. But for your business, you're thinking like a stochastic thing. I have one stock, which is my company, and I should time it as best as possible. So if you have a sustainable business and you're in a downturn, you're like, hey, it's sustainable. I can pull through this downturn. I know the right levers to pull to kind of preserve some capital and come back through. And there's an economic cycle at the end of the day. You know, right now, I guess the 7-year economic cycle sort of gone to hell. You would have thought that in 2015 we'd have a recession. But, you know, we've had this kind of nonstop kind of boom since coming out of the last downturn. But ultimately, if you're strong enough, you can handle a bit of a downturn and not have to sell into a weaker market and keep operating your business well and come back on the other side. And survivors do even better on the upside because some of your competitors didn't make it through. So suddenly you have some greenfield, fewer competitors, you start having some, as the market goes up, you do better than the market because you've come through. And then you really can time the sale. Now, if you wait till you're in your 60s and you want to time it for retirement, you pretty much peg that you're going to sell it on a specific date and not regardless of what the market is doing, and you've pinned yourself into a tough situation. But I think flexibility and being able to sustain through a downturn and show it can really help maximize outcomes. You know, we sold really, I guess, your LOI. Bruce came in November of 2020.
November 1st, we signed.
November 1st. And then March 18th, I think, you know, the transaction. April 2018 was like the best month ever. But we almost missed the market. I mean, Bear Stearns collapsed in February.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I'm sure, I don't know if you guys were if it was yet kind of aware yet how kind of volatile the markets were. I think we still were probably not that aware of it ourselves. It really took us till like May, June until we really started to get nervous.
Actually, Bruce, I do remember one data point. Is this true? In December of 17, you guys normally used like some sort of Merrill Lynch, like mid-market lending group, and that got acquired by General Electric Finance.
Yeah.
Which was sort of like an early warning sign that like maybe Merrill was like trying to raise capital or.
Yeah, something. No, maybe, but they did get acquired. Yeah. I still actually deal with that guy. So he's at another shop now. He's at another bank. So.
And it's a little backtracing, but roughly when our book went out hard and we were really talking to everybody in August, I think that's when one of Goldman's money market funds broke the buck.
So the real question, Rick, is should I short the market now that you've sold again? Because I believe it or not, there was another entrepreneur. He sold, when we bought your business, we bought his business, one of his education lead gen business. And he actually went back at again. He sold his second business there. It was called Quote Wizard. That sold to LendingTree. It's a big player insurance. And so, yeah, same thing. When smart people like you sell, I may have to just go short the market, and maybe that's my best tip today. Yeah.
I'd moderate that with the old adage of don't fight the Fed. If they're willing to dump a few trillion dollars more into the economy, I think we've got a couple of years left.
All right. So I'm going to give Bruce the final word here. Is there any parting thoughts? Anything you want to add on either our story with you or.
It's been honestly, like I said, as far as your story, it's been just honestly, a true pleasure and honor to get to know, you guys and Danny and Raj and, and the rest of the Engage team. And honestly, that's what each one of those learning experiences kind of builds upon, what you do next in life. So honestly, I've been doing this long enough that thankfully I really do only work with people who I have a general personal chemistry and affection for. And I have that for you guys. And look, it's, I say it all the time. Every week somebody new comes in with a great idea. And so that's the great, there are lots of issues in our country today. Entrepreneurship's not one of them. I think we still really, lead the world in that category. And so I'm always learning from some new entrepreneur, whether it's marketing or some other sector. And so it's, so I always encourage people have the conversation, look, even the conversation you folks had with your advisory board, I found that interesting that, you kind of roped them in lightly compensated. They were sage people. And I try to give back in that way too. I do a lot of mentoring honestly, it's a ton of fun. I now have a son who's in the private equity business. So I've told him it's time for him to step up his game. So, I can really retire and, focus on the true fun stuff. But anyway, it was really great to reconnect with you guys. And I'm hopefully we'll be traveling again soon. So we'll get to see each other in Atlanta or New York.
That would be great. Well, thanks for joining us, Bruce. We really appreciate it.
No problem, guys. Have a good day.
Wow, you made it to the end of the podcast. I didn't think people did that anymore. Well, since I still have you, I'd love for you to do two things. First, subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you're listening on. That way you'll be alerted as soon as I post my next one. And second, I'd love for you to subscribe to my email newsletter. I send out an email every week or two, and it's really where I share my more personal thoughts and ideas. Plus, I give stuff away sometimes. You can find the sign up at my blog, jeffhillemeyer.com, and I really do appreciate you listening.